From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. has accused Iran of supplying Houthi rebels in Yemen with a missile fired into Saudi territory in July and called on the U.N. to hold Tehran accountable. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has accused Iran of direct military aggression after a missile was fired Saturday from Yemen toward Riyadh. U.S. spokesman Heather Nauert said it's too early to determine who is responsible.
There was a missile shot into Saudi Arabia. The believed target was the airport or somewhere close by the airport. Imagine if that had happened here in the United States. It's shocking. I don't think it should surprise any of us that the government would consider that to be a potential act of terrorism.
Iran's foreign minister has dismissed the allegation as contrary to reality. Jonathan Edelman is a professor of international affairs at the University of Denver.
The Saudis, under the Crown Prince, is basically saying we want to go the modern way. Clearly, he's aligning himself strongly with the United States and also with the Israelis.
The Security Council is to meet Wednesday to discuss the humanitarian situation in Yemen, where the Saudi-led coalition closed access by sea, land, and air to cut off weapon shipments. Jens Larke is with the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
And if these channels, these lifelines, are not kept open, it is catastrophic for people who are already in what we have already labeled the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
An estimated 7 million people in Yemen face famine. A spokesman for the U.S.-UN mission in New York says Washington is not opposed to a modest increase in the number of U.N. peacekeepers in Central African Republic if they maintain high standards of professionalism. The Security Council is considering a draft resolution to boost the U.N. presence to over 14,000 peacekeepers. This is VOA News. President Donald Trump, before leaving for China, spoke Wednesday to South Korean lawmakers and said the success of the South stands in stark contrast to that of North Korea.
This reality, this wonderful place, your success, is the greatest cause of anxiety, alarm, and even panic to the North Korean regime.
Mr. Trump recalled the sacrifices made in the Korean War and told the National Assembly the North, with its nuclear missile program, should not try the U.S.
We call on every nation, including China and Russia, to fully implement U.N. Security Council resolutions, downgrade diplomatic relations with the regime, and sever all ties of trade and technology.
The president's five-nation, 12-day trip has been dominated by the twin issues of North Korea and trade. The European Union's top foreign policy official, Federica Mogherini, has warned U.S. lawmakers the international Iranian nuclear agreement cannot be renegotiated and urged them not to try.
So what I discussed with people on the Hill is the need for us to have the United States compliant with the deal. And I got reassurances from their sides that this is exactly the spirit in which they're working, to keep the United States compliant with the deal. And this is also our interest.
Last month, President Donald Trump informed Congress he was not recertifying Iranian compliance, thus raising doubts about the PAC's future. In Belgium, a defiant former leader of Spain's Catalonia region criticized the EU for backing Madrid in his fight for independence. Carles Puigdemont went into self-imposed exile in Belgium after the Spanish government imposed direct rule following a Catalan declaration of independence. He is trying to unite pro-independence factions ahead of December regional elections. Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga told the Reuters news agency he wants an interim government to run the country for 6 months while a constitutional review is undertaken to lower the risk of violence involving minority groups who feel excluded from power. He said he's willing to work with newly re-elected President Uhuru Kenyatta on such a revision. A police report revealed the man who carried out one of the deadliest mass shootings in the U.S. Sunday escaped from a mental health facility in 2012. Devin Kelly, who died shortly after killing 26 people at a Texas church, was also honorably discharged from the Air Force after assaulting his wife and stepson. U.S. astronaut Richard Gordon, who flew around the moon but never got a chance to walk on the lunar surface, has died. He was 88. Richard Dick Gordon was a test pilot chosen in NASA's third group of astronauts in 1963. He flew on Gemini 11 in 1966, walked in space twice, and was part of the Apollo 12 mission to the moon. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bhatti in Washington. Today's Wednesday, November 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Four Liberian political parties need to reaffirm their election challenge by denying they are supporting Vice President Boakai's runoff campaign.
The discussions that are being held is purely based on us collaborating and putting our efforts together to make sure that we get the legal victory that the country deserves so that we can be able to organize a rerun of the process.
Ben Sanvi is the national chair of Liberia's opposition Liberty Party. Meanwhile, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has thanked Liberians for their patience as their country goes through an electoral transition uncertainty. Another South Sudan military officer defects to Riek Machar's rebels, and Uganda's Prime Minister denies the police are partisan.
I agree with Ndugu Sereko that the police is for all Ugandans, and there should be fairness not only in the police but in all state institutions to ensure that Ugandans are indeed enjoying their democratic rights.
Ruhakana Rugunda is Uganda's prime minister. More and more civilians are caught in the middle as South Sudan war nears a four-year mark. Japan gets $4 million food aid to Burundi and a coaching course for women entrepreneurs in Senegal. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Liberia, the four political parties challenging the conduct of the country's October 10th presidential election on Tuesday met in the capital, Monrovia, to reaffirm their commitment to pursuing the legal process. Liberia's Supreme Court Monday ordered the National Elections Commission to review the party's complaint. The court also delayed the runoff election, which should have been held yesterday, Tuesday. Ben Sanvi is the national chair of Liberia's opposition Liberty Party, which is spearheading the legal challenge. He denies Tuesday's gathering was an endorsement of Vice President Joseph Boakai's campaign for the runoff election, if and whenever it is called. Instead, he said the gathering was a reconfirmation of the legal process and a call for the annulment and rerun of the October 10th presidential first round vote.
There is a commitment and a solidarity effort that we've come together. One thing is that we believe that the election that was held on October 10 does not and did not reflect the true will of the Liberian people. So all of these parties, led by Councillor Brunskin, who is our standard bearer, we filed a legal complaint. But yes, there is some solidarity. There is a collaboration effort for us to pursue this legally. And we're calling for the annulment and for a rerun of the October 10 elections.
As you know, the Elections Commission has scheduled a runoff. Does your party plan to support the United Party, meaning the vice president?
Well, we're not having any of those discussions right now. None whatsoever. We definitely cannot be undercutting our own legal case. If we go ahead and have political discussions with either the CDC or the United Party at this point, then we might as well throw our case out of the court. We believe in the case that we've brought forth. We know we've seen the evidences. We submitted the evidences to the National Elections Commission. And that's what the Unity Party, the ANC, and the ALP, all three of them, have seen and have decided to support us. So the answer to your question is no. No political discussions have been held between Councillor Bromsky and Vice President Boakai or Mr. Yuri or Mr. Cummings. The discussions that are being held is purely based on us collaborating and putting our efforts together to make sure that we get the legal victory that the country deserves so that we can be able to organize a rerun of the process.
But has the Unity Party, the Vice President's party, asked Mr. Bromsky to support him in the event of a runoff?
No, not to my knowledge. I can speak very firmly on that. All of the conversations that have been held, some of them which I've been privy to, have been focused solely on the fact. I think the vice president was at our national headquarters along with Mr. Cummings and Mr. Urie. And the vice president was very strong in his statement today when he talked about the fact that the elections that happened on October 10 did not reflect the will of the people. And so we needed to have those allegations and incidences of fraud and irregularities addressed and investigated in line with what the Supreme Court has said. And if need be, we will go to the Supreme Court to file an appeal.
So let me ask you again what I put to your standard bearer. Are you ready to accept any ruling from the Elections Commission, whether it goes against you or in your favor?
We are going to accept whatever ruling that comes from the Supreme Court. We already know that NEC is going to rule against us because in this case, they are the defendant, they are the judge, and they are the jury. So we understand what's going to happen. The chairman of the Election Commission have already made it very clear in press conferences that the Liberty Party case has no merit. So we understand what's going to happen. But we are going to seek an appeal at the Liberian Supreme Court. And whatever decision that comes out of that appeal, we will accept and we will abide by because we are law-abiding citizens.
Mr. Sanvi, so nice to talk with you and always a pleasure.
Thank you, and anytime.
Ben Sanvi is national chair of Liberia's opposition Liberty Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has thanked Liberians for their patience and what she called peaceful demeanor as their country goes through a period of uncertainty in its electoral transition. In a nationwide speech on Tuesday, President Sirleaf said Liberia's democratic institutions are strong and will withstand the test of time.
I commend you for your patience and your peaceful demeanor. Liberia's laws and democratic institutions are strong. They will withstand this challenge and they will stand the test of time. We can strengthen them by demonstrating maturity and not abuse our positions or misuse the platforms that have been made available to the country through news media and new technology. We must continue to respect each other, the rule of law, human kindness, and decency. Allegations, hate speech, insightful language has been defining what should be a proud moment in our history. I'm glad that all political parties have agreed consistently and publicly to adhere to the provisions provided under our laws. These provisions include the right to challenge through an established and orderly process the voting and electoral arrangements that have been put in place. Democracy is only as strong as its weakest link, and at this moment, our democracy is under assault. Our country's reputation is under assault. Our economy is under stress. We politicians must do better. Our people went the distance. We achieved 73% voters turnout, demonstrating confidence in our electoral process and the future of our country. Historians will look back at this time and judge us by how we conduct ourselves at this critical moment in time. We cannot fail them. We cannot damage our future.
That's Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf speaking Tuesday in a nationwide address. Another senior officer in South Sudan Army has defected to join the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition rebels who are loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar. Colonel Chan Garang said he wants to fight the government of President Salva Kiir because he says President Kiir arrests people who criticize the government in Juba. Garang tells John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program through an interpreter that he defected with 200 soldiers and is ready to attack Juba.
I left the South Sudan Army. I am Lieutenant Colonel Chang Garang Luau. Because the army and government of South Sudan, which Salva Kiir commands and leads, has failed politically and failed to manage the affairs of the army. They are arresting people left and right. The prison is full of thousands of inmates from Equatoria, Bal-Ghazal, and Upper Nile alike.
Before you left Juba, where you paid your salary, we hear people there have not received their salaries for quite some time now. Did you receive your salary?
I did not receive my salaries for 7 months. There's no money, only in the pockets of individuals. They say they wanted to start a national dialogue. We heard of the Gen Council and other things.
And of South Sudan, how are you going to do that?
I left with 200 men. Among them, there are 18 officers. And I can fight the government because I have joined the SPLA-IO, which is a big force and an organized force, and we are going to fight Juba and change the regime of Salva Kiir.
So you have joined the SPLA in opposition?
I have joined the IO along with my men and my 18 officers.
In South Sudan now, there is SPLM-IO led by rebel leader Riek Machar, and there is IO led by the first vice president, Taban Dengai. Which one have you joined?
I am with Riek Machar because Salva Kiir in 2013 said there was an attempted coup only 1 year ahead of elections that was supposed to take place. He said there was a coup and aborted democracy in South Sudan. There was no coup. But if he saw that you had support from the people, he would say you are attempting a coup. He got rid of many people. Nyangdeng Garang, Mabior Garang, Pagan Amum, Majang Agot, and the former governor of Western Equatoria, Bakasoro, and many others. People who had a political future in South Sudan. And we in the army are young, and we have a future in this country.
You say you have 200 men with you. Where are they?
Among my men, you find Denka, Nue, Equatorians, Zande, people from the Kapueta, Dendenga, Bari, and different tribes. And when I came here to this army that they used to tell us was killing Dinkas, I found nothing to support that. They welcomed me and received me well. I feel it's a national army.
Can you tell us what you're trying to achieve by joining the SPLA-IO?
I want for all the factions that have rebelled to come together against the man who wants to kill us all and imprison us from all the 64 tribes. I say we join our hands together and change this regime so that all South Sudanese shall be united after that.
Some people say you left Juba because you are angry that President Salva Kiir put General Paul Malong under house arrest. Is that true?
Paul Malong was the chief of general staff and was working with President Kiir and have nothing to do with him. I am against a regime that kills people wantonly. People have lost their children, their wives, and the prison is full of our people. This is not about Malong. The regime led by Kiir is wrong and unjust.
Where are you speaking from?
I am in Juba.
That's Colonel Chan Garang, a top officer in the South Sudan Army, who defected this week to join Riek Machar's SPLA-IO rebels. He was speaking in Arabic to John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program from an undisclosed location in South Sudan. This is Wednesday, November 8th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 18 minutes past the hour. The war in South Sudan continues to exert a heavy toll on civilians as the conflict nears the end of its fourth month. VOA's Jason Pantinki reports from Majale, Uganda, where hundreds of civilians are camped along the South Sudanese border after a week of fighting between government and rebel forces.
A funeral procession for a new casualty of South Sudan's four-year civil war. Duku Evans, in his 30s, was killed Friday amid clashes between government and rebel forces in the strategic Kajokeji region bordering Uganda, which has been an opposition stronghold throughout the year. As pallbearers lowered his body into a grave, his father, Moses Sokiri, held his head in his hands, shaking. He says, "I feel so emotionally bad because this is my son, who was always helping me in everything. Now he is dead. I really don't know what I can do. I don't know how my future will be." It's unclear who killed Evans. Three different armed groups have a presence in Kajokeji. The government army has been in the east of the region. The SPLA-IO rebel group of former President Riek Machar and the National Salvation Front, a new rebel group, have been in the west around a town called Sokare. Civilians have also stayed in the west seeking protection behind rebel lines after fleeing atrocities blamed on government soldiers. Fearing trouble between the two rebel groups, elders tried to mediate, but those efforts failed. In mid-October, the National Salvation Front, nicknamed NAS, captured Sokari from the SPLA-IO. Dube Sam, a 35-year-old farmer with a disabled foot, says the NAS commander told civilians to leave the area, so he moved with his family to a displaced persons camp near the town. But then, a week later, the government attacked the two rebel groups, forcing Sam and many others to flee the camp to Uganda. He says, "We were hearing the gunshots, the heavy artillery, the RPGs, the small guns. We heard they even had the armored vehicles. My feeling was definitely I will also be killed." Some of the SPLA-IO rebels who were chased out from there said the situation was bad and that we should move away. Numerous civilians blamed the rebel infighting for allowing the government to advance. Sam, the disabled farmer, says, "My own view is the fighting between the SPLA-IO and NAS weakened everything, and the Dinkas are actually watching them and saying, let them actually finish themselves, and when they don't have ammunition, then we will come. And of course, that is what happened. By Friday, only a handful of people were left in the camp, including a local elder in chief, Matatia Abangroka. That's when, the local chief says, the government forces, which comprise mostly ethnic Dinka, attacked the camp. Rebel forces responded. The local chief says, the Dinka came in the morning around 7 o'clock. They started shooting at the camp. Then immediately we took off because we thought they were going to kill us. It was sometime during this fight that Duku Evans was killed. He is now buried near the spot on the border where hundreds of civilians are camped, unsure of what to do, including Susan Kiden, 23, who fled with three small children. She says, "We are stuck because if we go to the refugee camps in Uganda, the life is full of suffering. The food isn't given out on time. But if I decide to go back to South Sudan, I will be forced to run away from death." With conflicting reports on who now controls Kajukeji, it is unlikely civilians will be able to return home anytime soon. Jason Patinkin for VOA News in Mijale, Uganda.
Opposition members of Uganda's parliament have taken Prime Minister Ruhakanda Rugunda to task over the conduct of the police in their attempt to disperse members of parliament who are opposed to the effort to amend age limit in the constitution. The MPs accused the Ugandan police force of bias in favor of those who support lifting the age limit. Mugumi Davis Rakarinch reports from Kampala.
Kampala Central Member of Parliament Mohamed Nsereko tasked the Prime Minister to explain why the police is being biased.
Political leaders from the NRM can be either district chairperson of the NRM, but also members of parliament of different areas. And they go within that capacity from now, and we've seen that in various meetings, conducting consultations and popularization of Article 102B. People that don't either red ribbons or have tojikwata ko like Honorable Mao have been stopped from interacting with other persons by the same police because they are anti-lifting of the age limit cap.
NRM stands for the ruling party, the National Resistance Movement, which has been in power since 1986. It is expected that the amendment of the controversial article, which puts age cap for one standing for presidency to be between 35 to 75 years of age, is meant to grant President Museveni, who will be 77 years in 2021, a chance to contest again. Leaders of opposition and those opposed to the amendment of the constitution have recently been arrested by police while consulting with the electorate. Many at times, the police have used rubber bullets and tear gas to disperse crowds organized by those against the amendment of the constitution. Speaking before the Parliamentary Legal Committee yesterday, Tuesday, Rugunda denied the government involvement in the police actions. He instead accuses those opposed to the amendment of what he calls provocation. Rugunda says the police is non-partisan.
I agree with Ndugu Sereko that the police is for all Ugandans and there should be fairness not only in the police but in all state institutions to ensure that Ugandans are indeed enjoying their democratic rights.
But parliamentarian Wilfred Nwagaba insisted the Prime Minister should come forward and condemn police actions.
Now, are you going to issue a directive to the police to stop its illegal activities against citizens from conducting their affairs lawfully?
Prime Minister Rugunda, without making clarifications, says the state will investigate the police actions. Last month, the police issued a directive preventing members of parliament from attending consultative meetings outside their constituents. Uganda's constitution grants citizens the freedom to assemble and demonstrate together with others peacefully. Those opposed the amendment of the constitution say it will enable Uganda to peacefully have a transition of power. For VOA News, I am Mugume Devisoro Karinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Japan has given food aid worth $4 million to Burundi as part of efforts to fight food insecurity in the country. As Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura, Burundi is one of the countries affected by prolonged dry seasons.
The Japan food aid grant worth $4 million comes after Burundi was ranked among the hungriest country in the world. The country was hit by the prolonged dry season last year that left more than 3 million people affected by the food insecurity. The Japanese ambassador to Rwanda, Takayuki Miyashita, said that the food grant will consist of 3,300 tons of Japanese rice.
Burundi has been suffering from food shortage due to the decade-long instability that devastated agriculture nationwide. Now, almost half of the whole nation is facing a scarcity of food, and about 600,000 inhabitants are confronted with more serious food crisis.
The World Bank report in 2016 indicates that the economic growth remains negative due to the fragile political environment. Private consumption likely weakened following the contraction in food production due to the climate shocks, longer than expected lean season, and forced migration. Burundi Foreign Affairs Minister Alain Nyamitwe said that the food aid will benefit mainly Burundians in the northern part of the country.
Food aid, which is granted by Japan, will serve the purpose of meeting the needs of the groups of people who have been affected by the drought, you know, which is induced by the climate change phenomena El Nino and La Nina.
The Red Cross reported more than 5,000 homes and thousands of hectares of cultivated fields have been affected by the El Nino climate change in the country. 15 out of the 18 provinces have been affected by the climate change in Burundi. The country's inflation rate, which was last recorded in August, shows that the inflation rose from 7% to 13%. Amina Hakizimana, a food seller in Bujumbura Market, said that the food prices hiked in almost every 4 months. She says that rice have become very expensive. Hakizimana says that they used to sell 1 kilogram of rice at $1, but now they sell a kilogram at 1.3 cents and doesn't expect the price to stabilize soon. Burundi is currently experiencing relative stability after the 2015 violent protest that led to more than 500 people getting killed. The country still struggles economically after European Union and the United States suspended direct aid to the government after the government was accused of human rights violations in 2015. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. In Liberia, the four political parties challenging the conduct of the country's October 10th presidential election on Tuesday met in the capital, Monrovia, to reaffirm their commitment to pursuing the legal process. But they denied the gathering was an endorsement of Vice President Joseph Boakai's campaign for a runoff election if and whenever it is rescheduled. And that is it for this Wednesday, November 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good Wednesday.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.